Good morning.
Good morning.
Please, the court, Tom Dupree, on behalf of the Association of American Railroads. The Constitution vests all legislative power in the Congress. Although the Supreme Court has permitted delegations of rulemaking power to government agencies, it has forbidden delegations outside the government. And yet that is precisely what PREA Section 207 does. It vests Amtrak, a private for-profit corporation with regulatory authority over other private companies in the very industry in which it is a market participant. The Supreme Court has spoken quite clearly. Although it is stated that private entities may have a role in rulemaking, that role must be ministerial, it must be advisory, and the private entity must function subordinately to the government. PREA 207 plainly fails that test. The statute enshrines Amtrak as a co-equal with the federal government. It gives Amtrak the role, in the government's words, of co-author of federal regulations. It empowers Amtrak to veto the government's preferred rule if it disagrees. And it even grants Amtrak the power to blow up the entire rulemaking and outsource it to an arbitrator who would then write federal law. Under a straightforward application of Carter Cole and the way that Carter Cole has been interpreted by the federal courts of appeals, Section 207 plainly affects an unconstitutional delegation.
Well, one question that I have, because when I look at the other cases that have talked about whether you can delegate to a private entity, they don't look like Amtrak. Amtrak has something in its statute that says it's a private corporation, but it also has a lot of government connections. What, in your view, is the strongest case that you can make for something that looks like Amtrak, for saying that it's wholly private in this context?
Well, the short answer is that the Supreme Court has never authorized delegations to private corporations over which the government exerts influence or can influence its affairs. And I would respectfully submit that if that were the constitutional standard, that Congress may validly delegate Article I authority to corporations that the government
may... a case that's somewhere close to Amtrak. You say the Supreme Court has never... Has it been asked to?
I don't believe it has, Judge Sentelle, but I think, in fact, that strongly supports our position and that this is entirely novel. If the Supreme Court had previously blessed this sort of structure or this sort of arrangement, the government might have a better case. But the Supreme Court has said time and time again that a telling indicator of unconstitutionality is when Congress creates an entity or empowers an entity that is new and different and never before done. And here, there is simply no historical analog. We have challenged the government from day one to say, when has Congress ever structured something like this, or more appropriately, when is the Supreme Court or any federal court of appeals?
I'm not sure how the novelty is likely to make it the case that there's no case on point, which I think is pretty clearly agreed among the parties here, that it's exactly on point. But I'm not sure it helps us decide which side of the line this particular case is.
Well, I think it does, Judge Williams. In other words, I take Your Honor's point that there's no case that's on all fours with this one. I think the parties do agree with that. But when the Supreme Court has discussed the non-delegation doctrine, it has been very clear that to the extent there is private influence involved in rulemaking or in the exercise of Article I legislative power, that's where the constitutional problem comes in, because the non-delegation doctrine, at the end of the day, rests in large part on the concept of accountability, that the government must be accountable.
Isn't this a case of double vetoes? Each side, Amtrak and STB,
FRA, in fact.
FRA. Nothing goes forward without the approval of both. But that sounds, in effect, very like Curran versus Wallace, where the this, I forget who it is. is coming. Justice Douglas speaks of Congress doing it, but I think it's actually delegated to the Secretary of Agriculture. It makes a regulation, but it only takes effect if two-thirds of the voting growers approve it. So that seems like a mutual veto situation.
I think it's very different, Judge Williams, and here's why. The difference is that in Kern versus Wallace, the government had unfettered authority to say what the law is, to make the law.
You say unfettered, but it's not going to take effect unless two-thirds of the growers approve, so that as a realistic matter, the government can, I guess the Secretary of Agriculture again, can do what it likes, but nothing happens without the approval of the private entity.
Well, Your Honor has accurately characterized that case, but I don't think that's this situation for at least two reasons. One is that in our case, the government, unlike in the Curran case, did not write the law. It co-authored the law. In other words, in Curran, the government's legislative actions were done. It wrote the law, and then it said the private parties, by referendum, will have an opportunity to determine the scope. It's an opt-in sort of situation. That's not this case. In this case, the government did not write the law. The private party and the government co-wrote the law.
That sounds somewhat formalistic to me. I mean, in both cases, no regulation happens without the approval of two sides.
But the difference is that in the current case, the government did not give away its sovereign authority to write the law. It wrote the law. And then private parties by referendum, which, by the way, is another way to distinguish this case. There's no referendum. In other words, the freight railroads, my clients, certainly never voted to subject themselves to this.
Does that make any difference whether there's a referendum or not?
Well, Judge Santel,
your point seems to be based on the role of the private party, not how it executes that role.
That's right, Judge Santel. I was just distinguishing the current case on that basis.
Isn't that a distinction without a difference?
Well, I'm not sure.
I'm not talking about your other distinctions, but whether or not there's a referendum, why does that make a difference?
Well, to the extent that that was part
of the parties had different names, too, but it doesn't make any difference. And I don't see why the referendum has any role in this.
Well, the referendum arguably would have a role if you look at Curran and say the Supreme Court approved this sort of structure where the government writes the law and then the precise scope of its application is determined by referendum.
But I didn't find anything in that opinion that seemed to depend on it being done by referendum.
Well, at the end of the day, I think the constitutional vice here is that Congress has improperly delegated its lawmaking authority, 50% of it, co-equal authority, to a private corporation. One of the points that the non-delegation doctrine rests upon is the concept.
You referred also this morning, and not much in your brief, to the arbitrator. Isn't that also a problem?
Absolutely,
that
Judge.
Ultimately, the rulemaking can be done by somebody we don't even know anything about.
That's exactly right, Judge Santel. We do think that's another facet of the statute that makes this an unconstitutional delegation. Section 207D says that the government and Amtrak, if they disagree, Amtrak can simply outsource it and have an arbitrator come in and write the rule. If that doesn't constitute an unconstitutional delegation, I don't know what would.
How is the arbitrator chosen?
The statute does not say. It simply says that they may apply to the STB, which shall appoint an arbitrator. But the statute does not limit the choice of arbitrator. It simply says the STB shall choose an arbitrator. And of course, for non-delegation purposes, the relevant question is not what the parties actually did or how they executed their delegable power, but what authority the statute gives them. That's the critical question. And that is why Section 207 is yet another way in which this affects an unconstitutional delegation. I think getting to the point of government accountability, the Supreme Court and this court have repeatedly emphasized that a key purpose of the doctrine is to ensure that the government is held accountable for its laws and regulations. And here, you have a situation where the President, where Congress, where Amtrak itself have all publicly, repeatedly, and emphatically declared that Amtrak is not the government. And in that...
But then the Supreme Court in LeBron said it was.
Well, with respect, Judge Brown, I think that the Supreme Court was very careful to limit its holding in LeBron. The very first sentence of the opinion, this is a theme repeated from beginning to end, says that we are making this determination solely to decide whether Amtrak is subject to the First Amendment. That's it. It was very careful. And in fact, in the analysis portion of the opinion, The court went through and distinguished its prior case on the very basis that saying Amtrak is subject to the constraints of the Constitution is something fundamentally different from the question whether Amtrak may properly be vested with the sovereign powers and privileges of the government. Even the district court recognized that the answer may well be different in that posture. One other point is that in Carter Cole and the Supreme Court's subsequent non-delegation cases, it is warned that a great danger of allowing delegations of lawmaking power to private companies is that the company would wield the sovereign's Article I authority to its own financial advantage. And that's precisely what has happened in this case. Amtrak was given the power to potentially rewrite contracts with the freight railroads and to coerce and force changes in the freight railroads.
That's fundamentally true in current as well, because I assume that the, except to the extent that the lawyers just saw a theory that might help them and they didn't like the system at all. The concern there is that the two-thirds of the miners who have a controlling voice are going to set minimum prices different from what the dissenting minority would set and override their economic interests. So I'm not sure that the distinction you draw is that clear.
Well, Judge Williams, I think it does just come back to simply in Curran, it was the government that was writing the law, and in this case, it's the government and Amtrak that was writing the law. That's the fundamental difference.
What if Congress had said the FRA will do all this, and it will take effect only when approved by Amtrak?
Well,
would you not be here?
I may well be here, Judge. But at the same time, even if arguably that would be a closer case, it still wouldn't fit into the Curran model, which the Curran model looked for a majority vote. Now, again, whether or not that's ultimately relevant in a constitutional sense, those were the facts of Curran. And here what you have is a single company, Amtrak, regulating the entire industry. That's very different from Curran. Curran, at least, could be characterized
a single company with opposing interest to the rest of the industry.
That is exactly right, Judge Sentell. And I think the fact that Amtrak's economic interests are directly adverse to the freight railroads is well illustrated by the fact that Amtrak has now sued one of AAR's members for violating the very regulations that Amtrak drafted and is demanding the government to order payments from my client to Amtrak. I think that's the clearest possible indicator that this is exactly what the Supreme Court was talking about in Carter Cole, where it said, don't allow for-profit commercial entities to wield the sovereign power of the government to its own financial benefit, its own commercial benefit. And that is exactly what has happened in this case. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. As the district court correctly recognized, Section 207 is not an improper delegation of congressional authority. It's wholly unlike the one time that the Supreme Court, more than 75 years ago in Carter versus Carter Cole, found an improper delegation in these circumstances. This is not, as was the case in Carter Cole, a wholly unchecked delegation of authority to a purely private corporation like the coal companies at issue there. This
Congress seems to have tried very hard to make Amtrak not be the government.
Oh, I don't think that's true at all, Your Honor, as the Supreme Court in LeBron pointed out.
Well, they said in the statute it's not a government agency, it's not a government entity. They seem to have tried very hard to make it not be the government. They may not have succeeded. Don't shake your head at me. You know that's true, counsel.
But what they haven't done, Your Honor, is altered in any way the relevant circumstances that were at issue in LeBron that led the court to conclude what it did there. The court, as the court emphasized, Congress created Amtrak. It sets the mission and goals for Amtrak. It provides
called it a private for-profit corporation.
It says it's to be operated as a private for-profit corporation, which the Supreme Court emphasized was perhaps a suggestion that the Congress was a little bit less optimistic than it was when it initially created it.
Is there anything in the controls that Congress retained for the government over Amtrak that does anything to to even suggest, much less assure, that Amtrak will not, in its relations with the freight railroads or whom it has a, or whose tracks it has, in effect, a government-imposed license, will not exercise that license and exercise all its powers as aggressively as it can.
Well, again, the question here is whether there's been an impermissible delegation of congressional authority.
Slow down. Just try to answer my question, okay? My question is trying to focus on why we're making the private government classification in the first place. And it seems to me that if the structure of Amtrak were such that we saw government intervening to hold Amtrak back from aggressive action against the against such entities as the freight railroads, that would be one thing. But if we see no such government control, no government control related to that issue, or even arguably related to that issue, then it's different.
Well, first of all, I mean, to answer your question, there are important controls by virtue, among other things, the fact that the Secretary of Transportation, for example, is an ex officio board member of Amtrak.
Is anything indicating that Secretary of Transportation is likely to exercise that influence to protect the freight railroads?
It could very well. In fact, the Secretary's delegee is the Federal Railroad Administration to serve as the functionary for the Secretary in connection with the board. And the more important point here is that the Federal Railroad Administration was the active developer, approver, and issuer of these metrics. This is not a situation like in Carter versus Carter Coal. We had no governmental input into the regulatory structure.
But I thought it had to be unanimous between the FRA and the Amtrak before it became an effective
regulation. It didn't. That's not true, first of all.
I mean, why are we here?
That's a good question, Your Honor. But it's true that there was a provision that that the Federal Railroad Administration has to approve these before they take effect. If there was an impasse.
Amtrak has to approve them before they take effect.
Right, and if there was an impasse.
What was wrong with what I just asked you when you said I was wrong?
Because in the end, it would then go to an arbitrator, which would be appointed by the STB.
My question then is, why isn't that worse?
That's not worse, that's because
you,
that would have just
been. Say that the arbitrator has to be appointed and confirmed, nominated and confirmed by the President of the United States, confirmed by the Senate.
No, but it could have been very
the
well.
Final decision maker in a regulatory scheme who is not even described in the statute.
But it would.
I find it shocking.
It's a facial challenge to the statute.
I know it.
And there's
Counsel, do you think I don't know it's a facial challenge?
And there's no.
Don't tell me something you know I know.
And there's
that
no.
The statute does not require the decision maker. Final decision maker on a regulation here to have been appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate.
No, but it does provide for the appointment of anyone the STB decides, and the statute should be interpreted in a way, if you found constitutional problems, as we pointed in our brief, to provide for the appointment of a federal official.
I read that in your brief, and the constitutional avoidance says we should construe statutes to avoid constitutional questions. It doesn't say we can rewrite them. And that would be a rewriting, Counsel.
That would not be a rewriting,
yes,
Your Honor.
It would. Yes, it would.
It would be providing for recognition that here in this facial challenge, we don't know who the STB would have appointed.
That's the problem.
The point is we know there's no constraint on it.
Yeah.
And moreover, it's important to point out that here, unlike in Carter versus Carter Coal, by virtue of the Federal Railroad Administration, we've got agency action. This is all subject to APA review. The plaintiffs could have added a complaint to their complaint, a claim that these metrics and standards don't comply with the Administrative Procedure Act and are arbitrary and capricious. They make various noises about their complaints about how far these metrics go, but they never added a claim under the APA.
The government doesn't satisfy enough that you're complaining about enough things.
I mean, again, all of this makes this markedly different from the unique scheme at issue that had purely unchecked delegation to purely private parties in Carter Coal.
You rely very heavily on Curran versus Wallace, and there the court distinguishes Carter by saying that this is not a case where a prohibition of an inoffensive and legitimate use of property is imposed not by the legislature but by other property owners, citing Washington X-Rail Seattle Trust versus Roberge. Why doesn't this case fit very neatly into that category?
Because, again, this case involved the Federal Railroad Administration as both drafter and approver of the regulations, setting this case far apart from situations at issue like that in Carter versus Carter Coal. Moreover, it's important to keep in mind...
I was going to Washington X-Rail Seattle Trust, where essentially it's the decision of neighbors which imposes restrictions on land, on inoffensive and legitimate uses of property. And at least it seems to me the appellants are arguing that this is imposing restrictions on lawful uses of their property.
Right, and again, without in Washington versus X-Rail Bridge, there was just a delegation purely and wholly to private parties without any governmental involvement, unlike here with regard to the Federal Railroad Administration's involvement. Moreover, let's not forget about the STB's involvement. We're talking about these metrics and standards, but it's important to note that nothing can happen to the freight railroads, unless the Surface Transportation Board conducts an investigation and concludes that there's been a violation of the pre-existing...
Why wouldn't that argument apply in every rulemaking review we get here?
I'm not sure I understand the question, because here...
Then I don't understand your argument. You're saying that this rulemaking review apparently is not ripe because the STB hasn't yet acted to enforce it.
No, what we're saying is that the metrics and standards themselves impose no liability on the railroads. The freight railroads
nothing
can only...
until it's enforced. Hold on a minute. I don't see why that argument wouldn't knock out every review of regulatory making, rulemaking that we have here. None of them hurt anybody until they're enforced.
Well, again, here the metrics also impose no liability even after they're enforced, because they only can result in liability if the STB determines that there has been a violation by the freight railroads of their pre-existing statutory requirement to provide preference to the freight railroads.
Yeah, but it puts considerable flesh on that preference requirement.
Yeah.
No, right. That's right.
If it didn't, it would be pointless, right?
If that doesn't create some new burden, why do you have the rules?
But it only happens after, again, first of all, they have a chance to get APA review.
That's a ripeness argument.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it also points out that there's been the governmental involvement in this case through both the Federal Railroad Administration, the fact that Amtrak itself has important controls government.
In a case like Washington versus Washington X-Rail Seattle Trust, nothing is going to happen, as it were, to the burdened properties until somebody seeks to enforce the zoning rule against violators.
But again, that was a delegation wholly without any governmental involvement to the private landowners. Here, you've got both the Federal Railroad Administration involved in the drafting, the developing, and the approving and issuing of them. And then you also have Amtrak, which in important respects, as the Supreme Court in LeBron pointed out, has important connections to the federal government in a way wholly unlike any private for-profit corporation. 8 of the 9 board of directors of Amtrak are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. The 9th is appointed by the other 8. The Amtrak receives crucial, more than $1 billion of annual appropriations from Congress every year. There's an inspector general in Amtrak. Amtrak is subject to the FOIA. Amtrak has annual reporting and other reporting obligations to the department.
Is your bottom line position that Amtrak is the government for this purpose?
At the end of the day, Amtrak, there's whatever you call
it. That's a yes or no question.
That's a yes. In the end of the day, Amtrak effectively is part of the government if for purposes, however you call it. It's either subordinate to or within the meaning for purposes of this case and this particular
case. Am I wrong to say that the statute directs the board of Amtrak to conduct the affairs of the entity in such a fashion is to maximize profit?
Not necessarily, not entirely. And that was the point of, look, the
Supreme Court. Is that in the statute or not?
No, the statute points out, the statute says something akin to that, but also points out a number of goals, as the Supreme Court and LeBron mentioned, that aren't purely focused on profit maximization.
Is any of those goals, does any of those goals reflect a sensitivity to the interests of the freight railroads?
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor, but it does focus on the need for a nationwide service in the name of national security and otherwise.
Yeah, but I don't think that's much solace to the freight railroads. I mean, that suggests that lines will be kept in operation even after they've lost all their customers. But it doesn't suggest that the freight railroads will be protected.
But that doesn't turn this into an improper delegation of congressional authority.
No, but we're trying to figure out whether Amtrak is private or governmental for these purposes. And the theory that on which we justify the government interference is that the government, we hope, will be open to the interests of all sides. And I'm trying to search for any equivalent in the structure of Amtrak. And you're not giving me a great deal of help on that.
Well, I don't think, again, the Federal Railroad Administration itself, through by virtue of the fact that the Secretary of Transportation is an ex officio board member, has input over Amtrak in important respects.
Well, assuming that Amtrak is a governmental entity, just for the sake of argument, assuming that that's true, is there any other government entity that regulates its market competitors in the same way as under 207?
I'm not sure I'm aware of any, but again, that's not, we're losing sight of the fact that this is not even regulation in the relevant sense. Again, this, we're talking about a pre-existing, but the railroad's true beef is with the pre-existing and long-standing statutory obligation to provide preference to Amtrak. And here, before any liability can accrue to a freight railroad, there's got to be a determination by an independent body, the Surface Transportation Board, after conducting an investigation with all evidence that the freight railroads want to submit, that they violated that statutory requirement.
But surely,
then and only
you aren't saying that these rules and markers are to be irrelevant in that process.
We're not saying that, and we're not saying that they lack standing here, but what we are saying is that this is not, by virtue of the extensive governmental involvement here, this can't properly be found to be the first improper delegation in more than 75 years.
During that investigation, what's the role of the Amtrak conductor?
The role of the Amtrak conductor?
Yeah.
They do prepare reports that provide data, but also
status is given to the conductor's reports.
It's used. They are subject to challenge as well if the freight railroads
subject
have independent
challenge. But are they not more or less the starting point of this investigation?
Yeah, and the agency. And again, if they had a problem with that aspect of things, they had every opportunity through the APA to challenge the use of conductor reports. The agency has explained why the conductor reports are the only reliable
ones. They should not allow this challenge because they didn't make a different challenge.
Right. This is a constitutional, facial constitutional challenge to the statute. This is not a question about just whether these metrics could have been done in a particularly different way that might have suited them better.
Just one question that I have. How important is it to your argument that we assume Amtrak is a governmental entity? In other words, if in fact we decided that it is private for these purposes, would that end your argument?
No, it would not. And as we pointed out in our brief, the fact that the FRA was involved as developer, approver, and issuer of the metrics, the fact that the STB also was involved, and the fact that Congress, and even if as the district court correctly decided the case, said we don't have to resolve whether Amtrak really is a private party. The district court quite correctly said that we don't ignore as well the important and unique connections
That's
between Amtrak and the federal government.
Sort of, I think Judge Brown and I, and probably Judge Williams, are all trying to get at, suppose instead of Amtrak, we're talking about the automobile industry, and there was a statute that said General Motors shall have the authority to make or co-make regulations governing the automobile manufacturing industry?
I mean, that...
Would that be a non-delegation problem, or do you think that would
again,
be...
Again, depending on the involvement of an analogous agency like the
FRA... Let's say that it could co-make with the Department of Transportation, and if they disagreed, then an undescribed arbitrator got to make the final decision.
When push
would that be a constitutional...
I don't think it would, but it's important to note that the Supreme Court expressly in LeBron distinguished the situation between Amtrak...
It's not a bit important to distinguish it.
No, it is.
My question. That has nothing to do. LeBron has nothing to do with the answer to my question.
But with respect, Your Honor, I've answered your question as well.
Your question, your answer was... In LeBron, now what is your answer to the question? Could they delegate it to General Motors in exactly a comparable circumstance to the one here?
I think with given the fact that you've got the involvement of a federal agency, both the Federal Railroad Administration and the STB,
exactly the circumstance you have here. If you had General Motors co-making with Department of Transportation the rules governing automobile manufacture, and the tie between them would be resolved by an arbitrator, in exactly that circumstance, could Congress constitutionally pass a law putting General Motors in that position?
I think they could, but again,
I want the answer to that.
But again, it's important to reference the fact that in LeBron, the court expressly distinguished the fact and made note of the fact that the Congress has, and the federal government has a more enduring involvement with Amtrak than it does...
You're ignoring the thrust of my question in Judge Brown's question. We're trying to find out if your argument is dependent upon them not being a private party.
And
each time you sort of answer it, you back away and start talking about LeBron. We're not talking about LeBron. We're asking you, can Congress delegate the role here to a private party?
And I've said, yes, we think they can with the involvement.
You think it would be constitutional to let General Motors have that kind of power over Ford?
Well, not without the important involvement of and control exercised by the federal government through the FRA and the STB. But here,
yes, and then you say all the reasons why your answer wouldn't be yes.
No.
Either your argument depends upon them not being a private party, or it doesn't.
It does not depend on that, but it is an important factor that makes this case easier to resolve. And it makes a case easier to resolve in part because the Supreme Court in LeBron expressly dealing with Amtrak, pointing out how important it was that, unlike in a situation like General Motors, Amtrak is a corporation over which Congress has enduring control over. It's not actually...
It sounds as if you're saying it couldn't happen if this were a purely private party. It couldn't be done. You say, yes, it could, and then you tell us all the reasons depending upon it not being a private party.
I'm just saying that this is an easier case by virtue of the fact that Congress has ensured that we have enduring involvement with Amtrak in a way that led the court to distinguish corporations like Conrail, over which the government had more episodic control.
All right. Thank you, counsel. How much time did Mr. Dupree have left? All right, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think Ford Motor Company would be very troubled to hear that it's the government's position that it can now be regulated by General Motors, provided that the Department of Transportation is involved in some amorphous sense. Judge Williams, let me point out two portions of the Curran case to follow up on my earlier answer to Your Honor's question. On page 386 of the Supreme Court reporter site, the Supreme Court says this is not a case where Congress has attempted to abdicate or to transfer to others the essential legislative functions with which it is vested by the Constitution. Then on page 387, it goes on to say that this is not a case where a group of producers may make the law and force it upon a minority. And here, of course, we actually have an even more egregious situation in that you have a single company forcing it on an entire industry. Furthermore, Judge Williams, Your Honor asked about whether there was any guarantee that in issuing its regulations, Amtrak and the government would be attuned to the needs of the freight railroads. The short answer to Your Honor's question is no, absolutely not. There's no such protection. That's why we find ourselves where we are today.
Well, counsel calls our attention to the status of the Secretary of Transportation as an ex officio member of the board.
I don't think that's enough for a number of reasons. For one thing is Judge Sintel correctly observed, there's an express provision in Amtrak's charter that says Amtrak, quote, shall be operated and managed as a for-profit corporation. I'm not sure how one would reconcile that direct mandate with the notion that it somehow needs to lay off the profit.
I mean, I think if you look realistically at Amtrak, it's serving a multitude of conflicting goals. Is that clearly true?
Well, yes, to an extent, though, Judge Williams. I think that while there are certainly some public interest goals in Amtrak's charter, there's a laundry list of things that Amtrak is supposed to do and to think about. But where the rubber hits the road is in the provision that Judge Sintel flagged, which says that here are all the goals, and here's how you are to run Amtrak as a for-profit corporation. That's, I think, the final essential mandate. Amtrak's directors also, of course, have a fiduciary duty to the corporation. They've never said that they don't, that ordinary principles of corporate law don't apply in this context. And so here you have precisely the situation the Supreme Court has warned about time and again. You have a party with direct commercial interests, antagonistic to others in the industry, that's exercising Article I authority for its own commercial benefit. That's what this case is all about. That's why 207 is unconstitutional, and we respectfully ask that the judgment below be reversed.
Thank you, counsel. Case will be submitted.